My name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education lead. And thank you for coming out tonight. And it's my pleasure to introduce Senator John Marty and talking about global warming. I just lost the other part. Global warming. Thank you.
Is the microphone at a decent volume?
Yes.
We're good? Okay.
Thank you. Glad to be here with you. I'm going to try. This PowerPoint was just put together today because I realized Sharon kept asking if I had a PowerPoint, and I thought, well, I have one for some of mine, but put one together today. And out of all the countries on the planet, we're, I think, the only country that has a debate over whether climate change is real. And it's something that's changed. It hasn't always been that way. Decades ago, we didn't know there was a problem with it, but as evidence became clear, it wasn't such a partisan split. In the 2003, 2007, 2008 years in Minnesota, we had bipartisan legislation to start addressing climate change and to start trying to get renewable energy. And I mentioned earlier today in a talk that one of my former Republican colleagues handed out, got reprints from Time magazine of a special issue they did in 2006 on climate change, an entire issue on it, and he distributed it to every legislator because he thought it was that important. And within, and by, well, 2 years ago, in our House of Representatives had a vote in, basically in a party line vote with one exception. Majority said they did not believe climate change was real, or that it was, if it was real, it wasn't caused by human causes, which is very unusual and strange perspective to have. And it's a scary thing. I think it's important not to scare people, but also to not to minimize it either. And this is one of the, I'm not the scientist, I do know carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases do trap in the Earth's heat, and it causes serious problems. And 408 parts per million, carbon dioxide is not a major part of our atmosphere. I mean, we're talking parts per million. So it's very, very small portion, but it has a big impact. And last time we had over 400 million parts per million carbon dioxide was 3 million years ago. And when it says seas were 15 to 20 meters higher, that's 100 feet plus higher than they are now. Back then, that's when megatooth sharks were in the waters, and the average global temperature was about 11 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it is now. And we may think, well, okay, 11 degrees warmer on a hot day is no fun, on a colder day, well, that's okay. But realistically, it changes everything about what trees live. Minnesota, they're talking about our boundary waters, talking about, well, 40, 50 years from now, we'll have a whole different look, different tree species growing there and everything else. This is one of the maps, just to show how, this is, if you can't see this is in thousands of years. 800,000 years ago, 700 so million years ago back here, this is where there are fluctuations, there are higher or lower periods over the years, and you can see just in the last very short period of time, a steep spike. They have to show the arrow because it's too thin of a passage to show where it is now, and unfortunately the curve is not promising. This is the shorter time frame, 1960 to 2010, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. You can see it's a very steady climb. And when it's compressed into hundreds of thousands of years, it's like a wall going up. And our emissions of greenhouse gases are continuing at record levels. We're hoping that that's changing, but it's a scary time. And I would argue that partly because of our politics, we are racing towards a cliff at a high speed, a climate cliff perhaps, and we're more likely accelerating in some people's minds. Some people are saying, wait, we got to stop this. But many others seem to be thinking we should keep moving forward, and so on. this is a time where last year and a half ago, the Paris Pledge, I think, gave a lot of people some great hope. It was every country on the earth, bar, I think, a couple of them, not major ones, insignificant ones, signing on to it, and the U.S. and China. We're the largest, they're second largest greenhouse gas emitters, both signed on. And part of the thing that was really nice about it was inadequate to address the problem. And people acknowledged it, and so they set a standard that their goal was to continue to tighten up. It's legally binding on those participating. Of course, they can bail out, as the Trump administration has said they plan to do. But they agreed, we're going to take a look back every few years, and we're going to set tougher standards. So they're saying, this isn't enough, but it's a good start. And I think there's huge reason for optimism and hope for that. Since the federal government is going a different way, there are frankly a lot of cities and states that are deciding it's in our interest to do it. Matter of fact, in 2013, I carried a bill that did a lot of things for renewable energy, for trying to get our solar industry moving. It would have required 3,500% increase in solar from 1970s to 2013, between 2013 and 2020, have 35-fold increase. That passed. We passed a lot of other provisions, and I had one that would require Minnesota to do some planning, the stakeholder process where we bring in all entities, business, energy, environmental groups, everybody, bring them in to figure out how we develop a strategy to move to 100% fossil fuel-free future. And because I can't tell you exactly what that roadmap would be, I don't think we have the technology or knowledge of how we would do that. I think every short term we know, boy, we got to do this and this and this. These are no good bets. They're things you ought to be doing. Midterm, we've got some pretty good ideas. Long term, we're not sure. But every 5 years, the new things come into clearer and sharper focus. And trying to develop a framework to do that, the timeline I argued for it, because we don't know if this can or should be done in 30 years, 50 years, 70 years, was that we should aim to be, as one state, aim to be the first state to be fossil fuel free. This was ridiculed by some, but it was part of the bigger energy bill, and it was kind of, nobody fought hard against it. It was just organizing a planning study thing for it, and unfortunately, it passed. But unfortunately, we got a year or so of progress on it, and then the last year they decided they were going to repeal it. And so they actually said, we're not going to do any planning for this. We're going to wait. In the time since we passed it, Hawaii's made a commitment to do that. They have a different standard because most of their heating fuel, their automotive fuels and everything are all have to be shipped there, and it's very expensive. So their electric rates and everything else are much higher, so it's much easier for them to do it. But they will probably be, because of that, the first state. But my argument is it's good for business. It's good for the economy. It's an important thing to do. And even if it wasn't, it's something we have to do. But with the Paris Pledge, we had some good progress forward. And then now we're seeing Trump administration and others, a lot of states, saying, we don't want to do this. We were grumbling. We didn't want to do it in the first place. Now we can get out of it. It's interesting, it's hard to get people excited about climate change when the early benefits, early changes caused by it are in many ways positive. This is an article of this February in the Atlantic. Everybody's enjoying Minnesota, 30 below weather isn't that much fun. A number of northern Minnesotans here who may like what we're doing now, and I think it's easy to say. And actually, this was an article, it was also in the journal Nature. This article came from the Atlantic, but it was from there. And they said, whereas weather patterns in recent decades have served as a poor source for motivation for Americans to demand a policy response to climate change, the public concern may rise once everyday people's experience of climate change effects start to become less pleasant. And so we're right now, like in Minnesota and many states, we're getting warmer winters, but not significantly hotter summers. But again, it's the kind of thing that we have thousands of different impacts in different places. And this article in The Atlantic, they were quoting the client scientists at Georgia Tech saying, those of us who have office jobs and bike to work may be enjoying these temperatures, but there are a large number of stakeholders in the agriculture community and so on who see doom more clearly than we do. And she said, you can't say that any week's warmth is caused by climate change. So I tell to my colleagues, feel free to enjoy it. But the staggering and humbling, worrying moment as a scientist comes when we see that 2015 shattered the record for 2014, and 2016 shattered the record for 2015 in the world's warmest year ever. And that's what's so scary. Right now we get some things, it's not many of them pleasant, but things are going to turn for the worse. And when you see the carbon build up in the atmosphere, that doesn't go away quickly, and we've got to deal with it. How is the oil industry and others respond? Well, this is a Delaware City refinery, which actually deals with part of their processing is tar sands from Canada and petroleum from the Bakken oil fields. They process that. They're on the coast of Delaware. Delaware is a state that is expecting higher sea rise, more dramatic impact on its sea rise than in some other places. And so the state has put together an effort to address the higher sea rising to help building walls and other ways to help mitigate this. This is one refinery applied for funds to provide a design solution, resilience to deal with sea level rise for at least 50 years. Here they are producing the dirtiest of oil, which is one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gases. They're driving climate change, but they want us to pay for it. And Grist, the online journal, said, what they lack in shame, they make up for in chutzpah. At least they aren't denying climate science, he said. And related to that, I kind of noticed the same thing. I attended a forum on energy, a training for legislators. I was chairing the Energy Committee several years ago and went to a thing that a National Conference of State Legislators, which is a nonpartisan group, used to be funded by the states. So it was in order to be unbiased and so on. It's states have not been contributing as much, so they're now funded much more by sponsors. This training for legislators in energy issues was largely sponsored by the petroleum and industry and so on. And it was interesting the reactions we got there. First of all, every time they made it clear it was a couple of 3-day seminars, 1 3-day in Pasco, Washington, 3 days in Washington, D.C. Very intense. They worked as like 14-hour days. So it was a good educational thing. But if they'd say, oh, we talked about climate change. We had 3 presentations on coal, one from coal mining industry, coal workers, one from coal mine owners, one from somebody else. And every one of them mentioned and talked about climate change, but it was always in the burdensome regulations and high cost of compliance, never once of what climate change means. And last year there was a journal that was trying to conduct a survey of coal companies, asking them for their responses. Do you think climate change is real? Do you think coal is contributing to it? Not shockingly, none of them responded, or they said, we can't respond. One of the companies said the topics are, quote, outside of the company's business and expertise. Yeah. And at that forum that I went to, one of the luncheon speakers, and they, it was like a cafeteria thing, you'd grab your lunch, you'd sit down and listen to a speaker, and one of them was a vice president or an economist at British Petroleum, and he was the one responsible for their oil market projections for the year 2030. And all the charts show that you're going to have significant increases in renewables, solar, wind, everything was going to go like this, natural gas and other things was going to go like this. The U.S. and Canada are going to be net exporters in perpetuity, and they were he was beaming. This was great news for them. And one of the legislators there asked him about the impact of fracking, because again, the thing that opened up a lot of these reserves is the ability to dig more out of wells that we could never have accessed before. And the guy said, yeah, fracking's been around for 50, 60 years. it's just the new technologies of bending directional piping and everything else and new equipment that they can do things they could never have imagined. So we have far more oil reserves than we thought 10 years ago even. And he was saying, no, we had no clue. Even though it's been around for 56 years, we had no clue what it would do. So I asked a follow-up question. I said, well, if you had 10 years ago, you had no clue what fracking was going to do, and it's all made your picture look pretty rosy from your projection. Do you ever factor in climate change? And if 97%, that was the number they were saying roughly several years ago, 97% of climate scientists said it was a very significant thing with catastrophic results likely to come ahead. If 97% of the scientists say that, at some point maybe things change, and politically and every other way you are forced to do a 180-degree reversal. Do you ever factor that in when you're making your projections about 2030? Because 2030 is a decent distance away. And his response was a very matter-of-fact comment that BP has a contract with MIT, and they consult with them on a regular basis about climate issues, but beyond that, they don't do a lot of thinking about that, which stuns me for a trillion-dollar company, almost all of whose assets are below the surface of the earth and being pumped up like this. And just as the fracking made it possible for their production to go way up, climate could have the opposite impact, and they don't do much thinking about it. And I think the thing I noticed is they don't deny the impact. They don't deny the science that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps in heat, and that does this, and that does, and that those charts are real. They don't deny it. They ignore it. And if you do it, after he responded about this, well, they, beyond that, they don't do much more thinking about it. And then, okay, now let's get back to what we were talking about before. And it's just, let's change the subject. And so that's understandable. That's their business. But it's a scary time, and we don't do much about it. It's just, when you can read things, the thing is, we can't know all the details, and it's not like the entire planet, everybody sees this much warmer every day and so on. It's kind of, we may have more drought in some places, more rain in some places. Minnesota a few years ago had droughts that were in some parts of South Central Minnesota. There were articles about how some foundations were cracking away from dirt because it was so dry, and then Duluth had a 1,000-year flood kind of thing, the torrential rains, and I think more severe weather is what we're likely to see. And related to that, a couple years ago, was asked to be interviewed by one of our political publications about the insurance industry lobbyist in Minnesota, a guy who doesn't share a lot of my views. I'm usually working against him, but he made a presentation before our committee. He didn't use the word climate change, but he talked very much about the industry's concerns about more severe weather and how homeowner premiums are going up like this and business premiums and other things going way up just because their losses are that much greater. And
can't hear you. Microphone
shut off. I thought it sounded like it went.
I'm guessing the battery went.
It's okay.
You might just have to talk.
I will talk louder. Okay. I thought it seemed to get softer, but I'm never quite sure.
There might be one.
Okay.
Just keep talking.
I will keep talking. Now I lost my
insurance.
Oh, the insurance guy. And I had talked with him before he made a presentation to us. He was saying how this is really a serious problem, and our rates are going to go up. Nobody likes paying higher rates, and the insurance industry is a very, very conservative industry, and they don't like chances, and they don't like to see the trends they see happen. And yet, because a lot of his allies in the legislature are people who say climate change isn't real, he'll admit, he says,
sorry. Okay, is that better?
Yes.
Too loud?
Yes. No.
Good. But he says he tries not to use the word climate change or global warming or other things because many of his allies don't like to hear that, and he wants to be sensitive to that. But he also can't ignore one of the biggest pressures on their industry and what it's going to do. I keep wondering if people in Florida, South Florida, are going to be able to insure their a lot of property in a number of years when many parts of Miami regularly, you can't build a flood wall around Miami because it's porous earth below it, so anything you put up, it'll just water go up behind it anyway. And so insurance industry is one of those that's kind of canary in the coal mine among business communities saying, we see this problem, we got to do something about it. In terms of faith community, the Pope, when he issued his encyclical on climate, it was extraordinary. Climate change has to be prevented from destroying the planet. He said our country and other wealthy countries have to bear responsibility for creating the problem and for solving it. And I heard a presentation from a poet from Marshall Islands who talked about how they don't expect to have a country. They expect to be entirely moved out of their country because of rising sea levels. And this is the French press agency radically worded letter. They call it radically worded letter addressed to every person on the planet. He blames human greed for the critical situation our sister Mother Earth now finds itself in. It was interesting this year, I don't know, I think it was before President Trump announced he was bailing out of the Paris Climate Agreement, when President Trump met with the Pope, they'll give each other gifts, as diplomacy does, and the Pope's gift to him was a copy of the Pope's encyclical. Pope's got some guts, and he said, he explicitly asked the President to read it. I'm not sure that will happen, but I was very impressed that he did. How do we respond? What do we change? What's the political world doing about it? Some politicians, as I said, don't believe it's a problem. Many politicians, I think most actually would personally believe it's a problem, whether they want to say it or not. But among those who do and say they really want to do something about it, you often have them saying what I would argue are timid. So, well, we love wind. We love solar. They create jobs, and it really does. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Energy efficiency, but also, you know, well, we need coal, too. We need oil fracking. We need everything else. Why? Basically, we support all of the above strategy. Why? Well, we don't want to lose votes over it. I'm not sure. I mean, I understand the concern. I mean, in the coal industry, there's a recent documentary out on coal. Connie, do you remember that?
From the Ashes.
From the Ashes.
National Geographic.
And somebody here was telling me that somebody in their family had worked on that documentary, actually. But anyway, it's a powerful one talking about how the coal industry, the mining industry, a lot of the miners have lost their jobs. Kentucky, I mean, it's not just that we're moving away from coal, it's also that they now just blow the tops off mountains. You don't need nearly as many workers for it. I toured the New Freedom coal mine in North Dakota, which is a massive operation. You could stand the scoop that they scoop coal out of the earth with is big enough to probably hold 50 people in it. It's a huge scoop. I mean, literally, it's almost, well, it's half as big as this room. And you can stand in there, it takes one scoop, pulls up that much stuff. You don't need a lot of jobs to produce an awful lot of coal for that. The Ashes movie talked about how a lot of coal miners had been promised they had lifetime health care benefits because of black lung and other things they had. They were promised as part of their contracts that they'd have health care for the rest of their lives. And now they're talking about how now the coal company's gone, and now they're reneging on those promises. And you know, it's a really critical thing. And I think anybody who says, well, we don't have to, coal's going away, so what? I think you have to address those concerns. So to the fact that politicians are sensitive to it, they should be. But it should be in addressing, saying, how are we going to find good other jobs, jobs that they can move into and jobs that can pay a living wage to them? President Trump talks about going back to coal. It's not going to happen. It's just economically doesn't work. Xcel Energy says they're shutting down coal plants faster than they planned. They're shutting them down early They're doing two right now, Great River Energy, which is a co-op and municipal power supplier in Minnesota and Dakotas and so on. They are shutting down a coal plant early. They're speeding up the dismantling of them because the cost is too high. And that's before they address all the environmental costs of it, which we've always ignored those costs. But so we have to address the jobs, we have to address the concerns, but saying, therefore, the solution is we're going to pander to everybody and say, oh, we're going to give you this and this and this. That's not a solution. If we've got to bring down the greenhouse gas emissions, you can't keep saying, well, we need oil and coal too. We have to find a way around that. In terms of jobs, I want to speak about that very briefly as well. It is interesting because Electrical Workers Union in Minnesota, they were very supportive of our big renewable energy bill a couple years ago, but when the lobbyist for it said he had to fight off, he has some of his members who work one of the big utilities, he said, I got 300 members working there and they're being told their plant might shut down and they're going to lose their jobs. He said, I got 300 other electricians out there in the field who are having huge new opportunities with jobs in terms of solar installations. And just to give you a sense of how it's growing, solar is still a very small portion of our electric and power generation system. But solar industry in 2015 had 209,000 jobs in the U.S. It's 20% increase in a year. Solar jobs account for more than 1% of all new jobs. I mean, energy jobs are a small fraction of it. But 1% of all new jobs in the U.S. in 2015 were solar, and it's more than doubled in a five-year period. And it's continuing to go that way. It is an exponential growth. It's expected to continue. Those 209,000 jobs, for perspective, that's more than all the oil and gas extraction jobs in the U.S. 185,000 in December 2015. A year earlier, it was 199,000. So they lost 14,000 jobs in 2015. The solar industry gained 35,000 jobs, more than twice as many. And it is a huge thing. Some states, North Dakota, I mean, it's a state's kind of thing. Some states like North Dakota get huge chunks of their revenue from fossil fuels. Minnesota happens to be right between all of these oil fields, and there's no uranium, there's no coal, there's no natural gas. We do have wind and sun. But we in Minnesota, our state budget's roughly $20 billion a year, and we spend $18 billion a year to purchase fuel to burn, all of which goes out of the state. It's about $18 billion a year. I could say, certainly figuratively, you could almost say literally, we burn that money. We're buying fuel with that money to burn. All of that's going out of the state. You replace $1 billion of that with conservation, energy efficiency, solar, wind jobs. Those are jobs in the state. They're manufacturers, they're installers, they're maintainers. And because you're not paying for fuel, all the dollars are going into the jobs and the industry. So it's a huge thing that has great potential, even in states like North Dakota, which will be the last states to make big changes in this because, hey, that's our jobs. But they are putting up wind plants in North Dakota. It's a lot of wind up there, too. We have to do it. To me, the issue addressing this is we don't have a choice. We have to address it. While some politicians offer timid solutions, then there are many politicians who oppose any action to prevent it. Usually, they say they don't believe there is a problem, or more and more commonly, they're not certain. I like to put this in perspective. Dick Cheney, former vice president, a couple months after 9/11, said if there's even a 1% chance that scientists helping Al-Qaeda build a nuclear weapon, we have to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response. In effect, he's saying, even if there's only a very, very slim chance that they could do something that's so catastrophic could destroy a human race, we got to treat that as a certainty. We need to respond that way. So how come some of the very same politicians who shared that urgency, understandable urgency, are now responding, well, only 97% of the climate scientists are certain. Why should we take any action if we're not certain there's a problem yet? And that's I mean, that's what the scary thing is. It is really a decision to gamble with the lives of people.
John?
Yes?
Getting back to what you were talking about this afternoon, isn't a lot of that driven by the Koch brothers and other oil industry people who say,
yes, yes,
you don't get a contribution. If you don't support this, we'll find someone who will.
That's largely the problem. We had a bill. I was the author in the Senate, and the House author was a Republican who drives a Tesla. And I'm a green guy. I drive a Tesla. He had hearings on a premature shutdown of a coal plant in Minnesota, and he tweeted out about how he was proud to be driving his Sherco, which was the name of the coal-fired plant, his coal-fired car to the hearing. I thought, this guy's one who's really big into tech stuff. I felt like taking his tweet and tweeting it to Elon Musk at Tesla, and you realize what this guy's doing. He's saying, your car is coal-fired. But anyway, so he drives a Tesla. He carried the bill in the House and pulled it into another bill. It was his suggestion. I don't like merging huge things into, it was a budget bill. He said he wanted to put it in. I said, okay. And a couple of days later, sorry, it's got to come out. I said, why? Some of our members don't like it. The last day of the legislative session that year, it was a constitutional deadline, have to adjourn by a certain date, and he spent an hour with the House Speaker and Senate Majority Leader arguing about keeping it, and asked the House Speaker, who was the one responsible for the decision, why? Who's objecting to it? The utilities weren't, they were supporting it, because they can't market these things unless we change the law. The auto dealers were supporting it, the auto manufacturers were supporting it, all the energy advocates, the clean energy environmental groups were supporting it. Who's opposing it? Some of our members. Why? I don't know. Wouldn't say anything. We heard from both some of the lobbyists in energy utilities and from a lot of the advocates that they were pretty sure it was Koch refining. Koch brothers who put the stomp on it because converting cars from gas to electric is not in their interest. But again, to those who say that, you know, the Cheney Doctrine, which, again, I strongly disagree with Dick Cheney in terms of how we respond to some of these things, but in terms of saying, you know, if Al-Qaeda was potentially going to get a nuclear weapon, even a slim chance, you got to treat it as if it could end the human race. And are we willing to risk survival of our human race? And this is the way, I mean, the Native American community often talks about the concept of the seventh generation, which is a beautiful concept. Every action we do should be viewed as its impact on the seventh generation. Why? Well, I think if you've got great-grandkids, you're talking four generations. Most of us can't name more than three or maybe four generations backwards. But none of us are ever going to know who seventh generation is going forward. I don't think most of us could name seven generations back in our households. But if we care about our kids, and we want them to be happy, and their being happy depends on their kids being happy, and their being happy depends on it, you do begin to get the sense that seven generations is a good way to look ahead. And I like to use the line, there is no planet B. There is none. We're talking about, hey, maybe we can send somebody to Mars in some years, and maybe we can send a whole colony of 50 people there. But the idea of sending 7-8 billion people there is not realistic. And when they talk about some other planets and other solar systems, yeah, when they're talking a million light years away, you kind of get the sense that it's not something we're going to see in our lifetime. So anyway, I think that's one of the reasons we need to dramatically reduce our fossil fuels. And before opening it up for discussion, comments, and so on, I wanted to say that there are many ways we respond. The two biggest ways are, one is individuals, how we treat things on our own and how we teach and educate and work with others. Holden Village is a place a lot of us learn ideas like this, as long as we don't get the idea that because hydropower here means we can people do leave lights on here, and we don't have to be as sensitive about it, but you hope people don't go back home and treat things the same way. But our own lives are a big part of how we do it. 2 days or 3 days ago in the morning, meditation, we're talking about the impact of how we can offset carbon by storing more carbon in the soil. Our agricultural systems, we've been taking it out in recent years, in recent decades, and we can reverse that and we can store it. Deforestation was part of the Paris Climate Pledge. We have a proposal, the French fry supplier from McDonald's wants to take more forests in northern Minnesota, in a very sandy area where you worry about groundwater contamination. And they want to deforest more of it for potato fields. And we were challenging the state agency that's supposed to do the environmental review. You should be looking at that, because governor and everybody said you're supposed to get all our environmental reviews, supposed to get all concerns. And deforestation is part of the Paris Climate Pledge that the governor and others said we want to stick to. But, oh, I talked with the potato company. They were really offended that one of my colleagues and I sent a letter to McDonald's complaining about clear-cutting forests. And I said, he didn't mind the term deforestation. I guess clear-cutting means you leave tree stumps and they weren't. He said, we're not clear-cutting, which I guess he meant you leave tree stumps and haul away the tree wood, but they're clearing it out and plowing it up for fields. So we're not clear-cutting, we're deforesting. And I thought, that's not a better solution.
Yeah.
But individually trying to make changes, and as a society doing that through public policy, it's amazing how our wind and solar industries are very significantly subsidized now. They're going down in the subsidies, which is appropriate as industries develop. It's not close to the subsidies we've given to other industries. Nuclear power industry, which I think is fading away just because of the sheer cost of it, has the biggest subsidy of any fuel in the country. And coal and natural gas and other things, if you factor in the health and environmental impacts of them, they've always been more expensive. We've never counted that in the past, and we should be. And as we try and address it, because they're real costs, it's a question of who pays them, and we pay for them out of our public health dollars and everything else. But clearly changing public policy can have a huge impact, and we as a planet don't have much choice. And but I'd like to open it up for some discussion about either questions or things about any of this, also suggestions on directions you think we as people can be doing and people in each of your states can be doing, or as individuals and families. So anybody have any beginning thoughts? We have about 20 minutes, I think. Yes?
Well, after we announced pulling out of Paris, I just keep coming back to this. That doesn't mean I have to. And you talk about, you know, states and cities, so I come back to our personal responsibility. I mean, I can live out the Paris Accords in terms of how I plan my life. And I'm just really hoping we're not going to get the government to do it. We've got to do it ourselves.
I fully agree with you about our responsibility.
Not to put political action either.
Right. But I mean, but if everybody in this room tries to downsize their carbon footprint very significantly, and a lot of us don't have a lot of control over some parts of it, but even if we do everything in our power to do it, and somebody else, you see the bumper stickers about people kind of trying to, hey, it's my land, I can do what I want with it kind of attitude, we do have to have the policy changes too. And in many ways, making the policy change enables people to do more. I would try and make the case that things like electric vehicles and more fuel efficient vehicles, we tried to pass a bill in Minnesota a number of years ago to require cars be more fuel efficient. The public tends to want to do that. If you hear, and it costs more to make a car that's more fuel efficient. Back in 20, 2009 or so, we almost got a bill through. Auto industry and others were fighting hard, and I would say fighting dirty about it with a lot of misinformation. But it would cost to make cars. It was, federal law says they regulate fuel efficiency standards. But when they put theirs in, California already had some. So they say, okay, California can have them, and we don't want to be fair to other states. So if they want to, we don't want 50 different standards, but if you want to copy California, you can follow California. California kept tightening theirs up over the years, and we wanted to copy California's, which was the other option. In other words, you pick this standard or that standard, we wanted to switch to that. We had a huge fight against it, and I think whenever you poll people on what they wanted, people, if you're told, well, okay, it's going to add $1,000 to the cost of your car, nobody likes that, but it will cut your fuel consumption to the point that you'll save $3,000 over the life of the car. Most people thought that's a pretty good deal. As a matter of fact, if you're buying a car on car payments, you'd actually be saving from month one. And but people don't have the choice because they don't make the cars that way, and you have to push the industry. Now, there was talk in the administration in Washington recently about the Energy Star program, the one that you get the little yellow tags on all your appliances, that maybe we don't need that anymore. The efficiency, the cost of refrigerators, refrigerator energy consumption from the late 70s, whenever that took effect, until now has been, I think the average household, $180-$190 a year with electricity saved just on refrigerators. And to me, a lot of people would like to do that, but they don't have the choice. So I think personal responsibility is hugely important, but if I'm a renter, I mean, as a homeowner, I can buy the most efficient refrigerator out there, but there aren't going to be as many efficient refrigerators if they're not pushed to it. And the other problem is, if I live in an apartment, the landlord's going to buy the cheapest fridge they can buy. It's going to be hugely fuel inefficient, and I don't have a choice if I'm a renter. And so I think it's a combination. As you said, it's both. It's the personal thing and the policy. So you said it that way. I just want to stress that you have to do both.
Senator, you know, I applaud, you know, we all need to make our own individual choices and to help with the greenhouse gases and everything like that. And things that we do can turn into a ripple effect that on other people's, as it's like, well, so-and-so's doing it and the other neighbor's doing it, so maybe I should do it. But really, every person in this room could convert to Teslas and save a bunch of gas and fuel. But it is nothing compared to when a big major corporation spends 4,000 gallons of diesel a day to do their project. It's, if we can't get, like you said, change the standards, if we can't get the big corporations to stop landfilling an entire dumpster a day, and they got a 40-gallon trash can with recyclables, they need to swap that volume. And if we can't get them on our in the bandwagon to make a difference, all I'm doing is making my life harder. And nothing's really going to change.
I would. The one thing I'd challenge you on is I don't know that it necessarily makes your life harder. But you're right. The rest, I mean, I agree that if we do everything we can and others aren't doing it, the one thing I'll say in a positive response to that, though, is that, and this is one point that's two sides of it. One is that over half of U.S. companies in a number of surveys have said they personally have made commitments to do much more in terms of green energy. Fastest ones to do it are the retailers, because they care about their customers because their customers see it. I mean, your insurance company, you don't know if they are, you're not paying attention to that. But if Walmart or Target or somebody else says, we're going solar and everything else, oh, they can market that. So they've tended to do that. But about half of all American businesses say they really want it. They're committed to it. They, for belief reasons or for marketing reasons or whatever, they're really interested in doing it. The thing that's scary on the negative side of that is almost all of them, like 90%+ of those businesses are represented at the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and in state capitals by associations, chambers of commerce, and others who are lobbying against any of these standards. So they're, and a lot of those businesses don't, they lobby explicitly on their own business interests, not on something they care about like energy stuff, but that's not their core function. They're going to lobby on their own specific needs, and they leave it to the Chamber of Commerce and others to represent them. And many times, Chamber of Commerce is not pushing it, so it's causing the problem you see. And it's not just in energy, it's everywhere. As you use the example of recycling, 5-6 years ago, I remember visiting Wilder Foundation, a major foundation in Minnesota, spends a lot of time on research. Their office building, they give all their employees, they have a little one of those plastic, looks like a miniature modern garbage can that all the garbage trucks use, but this big of one, had a little plastic liner in it. Everybody had one of those on their desk, and then they had some big baskets for paper and other kinds of recycling, and the garbage cans on their desk, they had to empty that themselves. The maintenance folks would come and empty all the rest. And I spent 5 years trying to get our state agencies to do the same in state offices. They finally made the change. We now have a recycle bin under my desk and a little add-on garbage, and we're supposed to pick up the one I think maintenance has been picking it up instead. But that's a change people, oh, we couldn't do that. There's no way we could do it. Well, I think we have to not just zero fossil fuel consumption, we have to have zero waste. We have to make manufactured products. Here's again where the personal responsibility and the public policy has to change. We manufacture products that you can't dismantle, you can't take apart. These things, they don't have a lot of precious metals in them, but when you dispose of hundreds of millions of them every year around the planet, most of them not being recycled, and not many of them easy to recycle, you can see what the problem is. And instead of mining new metals, which this place just spent $150 million cleaning up, we should be mining our landfills and our waste stream before they get to the landfill. Yes?
What is Congress's check on the administration when it talks about mining on public lands, drilling in national parks, offshore drilling? I'm assuming all of these are technically public lands.
Right.
Is the offshore federal administration in a position to make these things come about without congressional oversight?
A lot of them presidents can do. The thing is, in this case, I don't think you have a Congress willing to stop that anyway. I think there's no sympathy for it. I think the president on those issues is pushing what majorities in Congress want. So they could do some things, they could reverse some things, but it's kind of when President Obama was doing things moving forward on this, they were trying to stop some of it. They didn't have the votes to stop him either, but they've kind of, their Congress in the last few years have been a lot more sympathetic to what the current administration is doing than the other side. But yes, they could do something. If the trouble is they're hearing what somebody was talking earlier about, the money is very powerful about this.
But following up, technically, public, national parks are public lands, are they not?
Yeah.
Owned by the people. Nonetheless, the government could go in and drill on those lands.
If government wants to, yes, they set the rules. I mean, that's the kind of thing when, if the legislature doesn't like the laws it's created, it doesn't have to violate the laws, it just changes the laws. And a lot of the things, that's the thing, when Theodore Roosevelt established so many of our national parks, it was clearly not a partisan issue. It hasn't been so much a partisan, it's becoming more and more a partisan issue, and it's very troubling, because again, we're making decisions for the good of our people right now. With fossil fuels, it's literally 600 million years of carbon storage that we're pumping and extracting out of the ground in a few centuries. And it's, I mean, the first of the last 300 years where we were starting to do it was a fraction of a percent of what we've been doing in recent decades, and it's continued to go up. So it's something we got to be concerned about longer term than our lives. Yes.
So a question that's related but not. As a state senator, and I was your constituent, would you rather hear from me if I have a concern by telephone, by group email, or would you rather have a handwritten note?
Good question. I argue any and all of the above, whatever seems, I used to say, well, you know, you write a handwritten letter, it's going to have more impact, and so we get so few handwritten letters now. And I used to try and suggest the more effort you put into it, the more likely it's going to have an impact. Used to be, dear Senator, fill in the blank. I strongly oppose this as a sign, fill in the blank. Those would be less meaningful than when somebody write a letter on it. Nowadays, when it's just, if you don't like this, click on this and send a note. It will send it to the right person automatically, and you get a lot more of those. And there are legislators, there are politicians who are, at least figuratively speaking, weighing the mail. And if they get five times as many on one side as the other, oh, my constituents feel that way. They may be getting 100 emails instead of out of constituency of 100,000 people or so, but they may, oh, I'm never hearing from anyone on the other side. And so it makes a difference. However, the more impact, if you call, whether you're talking to a legislator or a staff person, whatever, express the concern, ask them questions. Why do you feel that way? Why can't you? Can you get back to me if you don't know? Can you get back to me? Can you read this? Asking people to read something. I mean, asking them to read a whole book may be a challenge, but asking them to read a short article or something is a reasonable request. So I try anything that you think works. Visiting with people, a lot of legislators in most states, they go home and they live in the communities that people live in, and it's worth doing. And I think a lot of people here may be in touch some with their legislators. There are two ways to make changes in legislative politics. One is influence the people who are in office, and the other one is replace them with other people. And both of these are ways that democracy should work. I wish it wasn't warped by the money, which is another big issue we have to address, because it, as we've been saying, it affects all these issues. Try everything. Yes?
Well, something that has come up more recently and maybe the last couple of the elections are the number of emails pouring in if they know you are on a certain party. And there are so many different emails, you don't know if this is legitimate anymore. I mean, how are you aware of this happening?
In terms of where people are, you mean somebody could just send blast emails?
The Brown Association wants you to write your legislature about this.
And sometimes if somebody wants, they can. I've seen some cases where, at least it's been alleged that people said, I didn't sign something like that. How come you got to? Because some legislators, some of my colleagues have written people back in response to an email saying they support something, and the person said, I didn't write you on that. And so how much is real, I don't know. There's no easy way to do it, nor is there an easy way to tell people how to pay attention to what's going on. Used to be, you read the newspaper. The newspaper industry has gone way down. There's so many more sources of information, but there's no consistent, reliable way to get information on a wide range of public policy issues. TV news is not it.
Which groups do you trust?
I would say look at the groups that you trust.
Proactive on the environment. Suddenly there will be 12 different groups or something.
But
like
if you
that.
Talk with people, if you get involved with some groups or you trust some groups, or you have friends who care about it, ask them the groups they trust about, because there's the proliferation of groups and causes.
I'm doing that sort of thing, but it's just really amazing.
And talking with others who are active in it, you get a sense of which
groups. You just have to pare it down.
Right.
But, you know, sometimes there will be a byline that, I do agree with that. But then,
on any issue,
this group at all.
on any issue. Any, we have about 3 more minutes if anybody has any. Yes?
Just to address that, on the national level, our Evangelical Lutheran Church in America has advocacy in Washington, D.C. And so if you go to the ELCA webpage,
okay.
You can get on their email list, and you definitely can trust them.
Okay.
We can very personally have access to the people who are the advocates.
There are a number of groups, again, depending on church
There's
groups.
There's some that, familiar ones.
Right, and, yeah. And use them. I mean, that's about the best way. It's not a perfect way to do it. My biggest argument would be that the fact that so much of the decisions are made by the money. I don't think it's intentional. It's not an accusation that politicians are corrupt, but it's an accusation that they're human. And when people are getting them elected by doing this, it's you can't. I cannot envision the nation's founders envisioning it happening this way. So one last one.
Yes. In response to that, there's also within Washington State, for those of you who are residents of Washington State, it's called FAN, which is a Faith Advocacy Network.
Oh, okay.
That is
denominational.
Mm-hmm. And it's run out of Olympia. Paul Benz, who is a Lutheran pastor, is director of that. So
if you live in Washington State?
FAN. Mm-hmm. F-A-N.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I'll be around.